Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Carolina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop treatment update on soft tissue sarcoma. This is an incredibly important program that we're offering today, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 537 participants, so there's a lot of you on the call. It's a very large teleconference, and we have participants from all of the United States, all different areas of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Korea, South Africa, Spain, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world as a group of information seekers. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about all of our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you. And there also is an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of our program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer in the programs that we offer? Indeed, we are entering 2012 very soon, and we're planning many programs for next year. And your feedback could not be more timely to us at this time. Indeed, today's workshop and the topic is one that many of you have asked us to offer. And so here it is. And again, just let us know what you want us to do, and we'll try very hard to do it. Today's program was made possible by support from Ziopharm Oncology, and I really want to thank them for supporting this program. And they also have supported a booklet on sarcoma, which you'll be getting shortly as well. So you'll be getting something in addition then to the workshop as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. George Dimitri. Dr. Dimitri is Director, Ludwig Center at Dana-Farber, Harvard Cancer Center and Sarcoma Center, Senior Vice President for Experimental Therapeutics, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Dimitri is going to present an overview of soft tissue sarcoma, including current standard of care. He's going to talk about new approaches and the importance of clinical trials and pain and symptom management. It's my pleasure and privilege to turn this program over to Dr. Dimitri.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and welcome to everybody. I appreciate you all joining us today. I want to introduce this topic simply because there is such a great deal of interest in this, and there's lots of reasons for that. Sarcomas used to be a forgotten disease. They're certainly not in the news like breast cancer or ovarian cancer or even lung cancer because it's not very common. In the United States, for example, there's nearly 200,000 new diagnosed cases of breast and lung cancer each, whereas sarcomas are perhaps at most 15,000 new cases. But if you're one of those 15,000, you want to know everything you possibly can about the disease. So we appreciate all of you joining here so that we can just introduce these topics. Sarcomas are cancers that arise in cells that are ordinarily responsible for holding the body together, so-called connective tissues. And these cells, in a very primitive state, come from something called mesenchyme. So these are almost always referred to as mesenchymal or mesenchymal malignancies. A little bit of histology for you. You don't need to know that, but the mesenchyme is a scary word. When you hear I have a mesenchymal tumor, all it means is something that if that cell were to grow up and be normal, it would hold the body together. So what holds the body together? We're talking things like bone, cartilage, even fat, the nerve cells, all sorts of things derived from mesenchyme. So many of these things, if they go astray, can turn into cancers, and that's an important element. So when you're talking about things like bone and muscle and nerve and cartilage, it's all over the body. So sarcomas do not start in one part of the body. They can actually start virtually anywhere in the body. And then we define them by usually what they look like or sometimes what they don't look like. There are sometimes sarcomas that are so primitive, that haven't grown up enough to really put them in a bin. They don't look like muscle, they don't look like nerve, they don't look like bone. So they go into a bin called undifferentiated. We don't know what they are. The biggest split for sarcomas that we deal with is, did it start in the bone or did it start outside the bone? Outside the bone are things that are softer than bone, so they get called soft tissue sarcomas. And in that group is the biggest group of sarcomas. There's probably about 10 soft tissue sarcomas for one bone tumor. Bone tumors or bone sarcomas are much more rare than soft tissue sarcomas. Soft tissue sarcomas in adults are only about 1% of human cancers in adults. They're not that common. I want to emphasize that. In kids, because kids don't get a lot of the cancers that grown-ups get, though, sarcomas are more proportionally numerous. So about 15% of childhood cancers are sarcomas, where only 1% of adult cancers are. Still, thankfully, cancers in children are very rare, and sarcomas in kids are really quite rare as well. Importantly, the kinds of sarcomas that children get tend to be a little bit more the bone tumors, and those are often curable, very curable in children. In fact, bone tumors like osteosarcoma, when they're limited to one part of the bone, can be very curable in adults as well. And I want to emphasize this also. Soft tissue sarcomas can be very curable if they're limited. And that emphasizes the role of the team in this. The current standard of care for sarcomas is to have a team that works together, that talks to each other, that knows this disease. And that team is important right from the very first time a doctor suspects sarcoma. Because if a doctor is seeing a patient, that patient has a lump, and they don't even think about sarcoma, if they perhaps were to try to biopsy or take that lump out, they could possibly hurt the patient by orienting the scar in the wrong way and impacting the function of, let's say, an arm or a leg, and making subsequent surgery more difficult or possibly impossible. So we think it's important that doctors be aware of this and that patients feel empowered to say, you know, how do you know that's a sarcoma, and to work with their doctors to potentially get an expert opinion from a team that's used to dealing with sarcomas. Our center here in Boston deals with more than 1,500 sarcoma referrals a year. Other big centers in New York City or Texas or Chicago, many places have sarcoma centers that see a lot of patients with sarcomas. And I think it is important to have a team made up of a surgeon who deals with sarcomas. That can be a general surgeon or a surgical oncologist or an orthopedic, a bone specialty surgeon, as well as a medical oncologist like myself. I'm a medical oncologist. I deal mainly with treatments that are drug-based, but sometimes just coordinate the care amongst the whole team. Radiation oncologists can often be part of the team, not always, but we have a radiation oncologist, Dr. Delaney, on the line, who will talk about that as well. And then people you might never see who are really critical, like the people who make the initial diagnosis. A pathologist is somebody who takes a sample of tissue and tells us, as the treating physicians, what the disease is. Pathologists are absolutely critical in sarcomas, more than most any other cancer I know of, because the expertise to diagnose a sarcoma is extraordinary. There are probably more than 1,000 different kinds of sarcomas, and to be able to tell one from the other demands a great deal of expertise, and there's not that many expert sarcoma pathologists in the country. So we think you always start with questioning the diagnosis and possibly confirming it, and then dealing with a team that says, what's the right way to approach this patient for the best possible outcomes? Hopefully cure, but even if cure is not possible, to try to prolong life, to basically make people feel better, and to give everybody the best possible shot at controlling the disease and having the maximal function as long as possible. So that standard of care is critical, and I don't want to focus too much on the differences about how we focus on a limited sarcoma, let's say one lump that has not spread anywhere else, versus a sarcoma that may have started in one place and also have spread somewhere else. But those are the important things. Very often, sarcomas can be highly curable if they're localized, and even some sarcomas can be curable if they've spread a little bit distant from where they started. So there are important things to talk to a doctor about, and doctors have to be knowledgeable about this disease. They have to be honest with the patients to have the right goals of care be part of the process, and to be talking about some of the new things that are coming around. Because in sarcomas, more than for many other kinds of cancers, there are new drugs, new approaches, and new evidence that justifies giving patients a shot at improving their outcomes with new tools that we didn't have even 5 years ago. So in the old days, all we had, when I say the old days, this is before I started in this field, so before the 1970s, we did not have chemotherapy, and even radiation was rather primitive. So all we had was surgery. Nowadays, the surgery is both more sophisticated, and the surgical outcomes are much better, because the ability to add to the benefits of surgery with radiation treatments are really quite extraordinary, and occasionally to add to the benefits of surgery with drug therapy as well. And when I say drugs, I don't necessarily just mean chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is getting better than ever. We can give safer and more effective chemotherapy that does not necessarily impact so negatively on a patient's quality of life. So the drugs are getting better, but also we have new targeted therapies. Drugs that are specifically going after abnormal things that are inside the cancer cell, things that are like mutations that drive the cancer cell to be a cancer cell and that may only exist in that cancer cell. Certain proteins are shaped abnormally and they make the cancer cell what it is. So if we can give a drug that goes after abnormally shaped proteins, for example, maybe we'll only hurt the cancer cell and leave the normal cells alone. That's the dream, the silver bullet of targeted therapy, is to do that sort of thing. And a lot of that work has been done in sarcomas such as gastrointestinal stromal tumor, a type of sarcoma, but really the one that showed that if we understand the tumor, we can develop better, safer, more effective drugs than ever before. And now we have many other new drugs in clinical trials, drugs that have actually proven their worth in comparative clinical trials that patients have been generous enough to participate in. These drugs are often things like targeted therapies that go after different enzymes and different proteins in the cells, and I don't want to belabor these points because it's changing. And a lot of this is with us as the medical and scientific community talking to the Food and Drug Administration to say what's worth it to a patient. How do we prove that controlling the disease for an extra number of months is of value to patients? These are the sorts of things we're in discussions with regulatory colleagues across the world. And it's an exciting time to be doing drug development for sarcoma patients, because in general we have not had a lot of drugs to use in this disease. We've had old-style chemotherapy from the decade of the 1970s, then there were some other new chemotherapy drugs that came out in the 1980s, and now finally we have other new drugs that have proven their worth in big comparative worldwide studies. Finally, I just want to emphasize the fact that even with advanced sarcomas, patients can do remarkably well under the care of a team that pays attention to the needs of a patient. We always focus on the quality of life that patients have in addition to the quantity of life. It's important to focus on both, and I think that's what a good team managing sarcoma patients will do. If you have a patient who can have a cure, many patients are willing to say, put me through whatever it takes, I want to go for that cure. If a patient cannot be cured, it's important to be honest with them and say, we don't think we can cure you, but let's try to buy as much time as possible without hurting you, without decreasing your quality of life, because we may have a breakthrough drug just next year. We may have a new drug that comes from some of the new research that's going on. So I don't think there's ever been a more optimistic time that I know of in the last 25 years to be a part of this process, and it's an honor for me to be a part of this team that's talking to you today, really just skimming the surface, introducing the concepts of sarcomas, and then we'll have some question and answers later to go into a few details. So with that, I'd set my iPhone here to tell me when I was talking too long. That was the signal in the background. I don't know if you heard that, but the alarm just went off. So I will pass the baton to my next colleague. Carolyn, will you introduce Dr. Wayne?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dimitri, just for such an informative and such a dedicated, excellent presentation. Outstanding. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Wayne. And Dr. Wayne is Associate Professor of Surgery, Chief Melanoma and Soft Tissue Surgical Oncology, Division of Gastrointestinal and Oncologic Surgery, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Associate Medical Director, Robert H. Lurie Cancer Center. And Dr. Wayne is going to address the role of surgery in the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma, the importance of the pathology report, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Wayne.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, George. I agree. That was really a wonderful summary of some of the new and exciting things that are going on in the world of sarcoma. That being said, in this day and age, surgery still plays a primary role in the treatment of patients with soft tissue sarcoma, whether it be an extremity sarcoma or a retroperitoneal sarcoma. However, as George underlined, surgery alone is rarely the treatment of choice. The multimodality approach, combining surgery, radiation, and in most cases in this day and age, or certainly in a substantial proportion of cases in this day and age, chemotherapy has really become the rule. And as George mentioned, you know, having expertise in all these various fields, whether it be pathology, surgery, medical oncology, and radiation oncology, as well as, I would say, cross-sectional imaging, having a good radiologist to help guide the testing that we do, is something that is rare to find in smaller centers, and thus concentration of these complex patients in the larger referral centers has become the norm. As George mentioned, sarcomas, especially of the extremity, typically present as some type of painless swelling or mass, and sometimes in sarcoma, it's what you do not do as opposed to what you do that can make a difference. As George alluded to, in this day and age, we'll often obtain a diagnosis via core needle biopsy, obviating the need for a excisional or surgical biopsy, and this allows patients to get on to treatment sooner. Does obviates any type of surgical complications, and frankly, will typically provide enough tissue to provide a adequate diagnosis. Once the diagnosis has been established, I think that's, again, where patients should start asking questions and seeking opinions. And you know, even as as someone who is thought of as an expert in my particular area, I will never discourage a patient from getting a second opinion. I think it's a crucial part of their care. I think, you know, patients need to feel very comfortable with their own treatment plan and need to feel that they can go forward without having regrets that they should have taken certain other steps along the way. So having a fresh set of eyes to look at the problem is never wrong, and I think if you run into a physician or a doctor who is trying to dissuade you from a second opinion, that should be a red flag, and should cause you to take pause and think about what all your options are. Essentially, at this point, once the core needle biopsy is performed, you know, at this point, radiologic imaging is typically undertaken, or sometimes the radiologic imaging leads to the core needle biopsy. I think MRI or CT are the most commonly used modalities, typically for retroperitoneal or abdominal sarcomas. CT scans are perhaps more prevalent for sarcomas of the extremity. CT or MRI is acceptable, and again, it's dependent upon comfort of the surgeon as well as expertise of the radiologist. But either way, appropriate imaging should be performed, and it should be of sufficient quality to allow for identification of critical structures in the area and structures that may be involved by the process in question. Obviously, the other key component in this early stage of the workup is to rule out distant metastatic disease. And in general, for most sarcoma patients, that involves some type of chest imaging to rule out pulmonary metastasis, but if it's a tumor of the abdomen or lower extremities, then abdominal and pelvic imaging may also be appropriate. At this point, this is where in an ideal world, we'd like to see every case discussed at a multidisciplinary sarcoma conference, or at least a multidisciplinary tumor conference, depending on local expertise. again, not only deciding what therapies, again, be that surgery, be that radiation initially, or even be that chemotherapy to start, might be used, and in what order. And again, We don't necessarily, for instance, to give the example, and I know Tom will talk about radiation down the line, but, you know, we don't necessarily have good data that giving radiation before surgery provides better survival than giving it after surgery, but there may be a very important technical consideration that impacts upon the surgery, or it may be make the radiation much tougher to give it after surgery. And so in certain situations, you know, we do like to start with a neoadjuvant approach, whether that be neoadjuvant chemotherapy, neoadjuvant radiation therapy, or both. Then when a patient is deemed appropriate for surgical resection, again, typically if they've undergone some any type of treatment, there's restaging. In other words, the images are repeated and careful surgical planning is undertaken. Surgery in the extremities is the goal, or and for the in the retroperitoneum for that matter, the goal is to obtain what we call an R0 margin, or a negative histologic margin, meaning there's no microscopic tumor cells at the edges of the resection specimen. And this, you know, is sometimes easier said than done, and this is where the real art of surgery comes into play. It may be necessary to take critical structures in the area and perhaps reconstruct them, such as reconstructing blood vessels. It may require the use of soft tissue flaps, in other words, involving a plastic surgeon to help with either filling a defect or perhaps even reconstructing a nerve or any of the other things that we do, or as George mentioned, orthopedic oncologists may also play a role here, either as the primary surgeon or to help with either resecting a bony structure or reconstructing a bone if that's necessary to, again, obtain a negative histologic margin. And in this day and age, and you know, perhaps one of the crowning achievements of modern medicine from the 70s to now is to promote a limb-sparing approach in the treatment of patients with sarcoma. In other words, it's very rare in this day and age, perhaps in only 5% of cases are left, to have to undergo amputation for sarcoma, which may have been much more commonplace in the 60s, 70s, and perhaps even the early 80s. But in this day and age, we aim to do a surgery that provides for negative margins and spares critical structures, such that the patient maintains function post-surgery. And I think it's important also to remember, once the recovery from surgery begins, that also includes rehabilitation, so involving our rehabilitation specialists. And again, trying to either maintain or regain function after surgery is a crucial part of recovery. I think I'm probably nearing the end of my portion of this talk. Also, I want to give Tom enough time to talk, and I want to allow for as many questions as we can take from our audience. But I think, again, once surgery is complete, again, that's when the patient's case should be represented at a multidisciplinary conference. We will all reconvene. There'll be a pathologist there to show the specimen, a radiologist to look at the pre and post surgical imaging, and obviously the medical oncologist and surgeon to talk about the surgical details and whether or not any adjuvant therapy, meaning giving radiation and/or chemotherapy after a successful surgery, might be indicated. So again, there's numerous steps along the way where again a multidisciplinary discussion and conversation should take place. And you know, frankly, you know, in terms of ongoing follow-up, again, these patients need very good plans for their long-term follow-up, because we know in sarcoma, unlike some of the more common cancers, we can see late recurrences and unusual recurrences. And so formulating a disease-specific follow-up strategy that aims to identify recurrences early and when a therapeutic intervention could be undertaken is also a very critical part of the care of patients with sarcoma. So again, I'm going to wrap it up at this point, and I'm going to let Carolyn introduce our next speaker to you. And again, I look forward to any and all of your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wayne. Just a wonderfully excellent presentation, just lots of information and very well presented. Just, you know, again, an outstanding presentation. This is quite a remarkable team that we have here, I have to say. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Delaney. Dr. Delaney is professor of radiation oncology, Harvard Medical School, radiation oncologist, Department of Radiation Oncology. He's medical director, Francis H. Burr Proton Therapy Center, co-director, Center for Sarcoma and Connective Tissue Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Delaney is going to address the role of radiation oncology, how research contributes to treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Delaney?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'll be discussing the role for radiation therapy in soft tissue sarcomas, and a lot of my remarks will echo those from Dr. Wayne and Dr. Dimitri. For many kinds of sarcomas, combining surgery with radiation treatment has proven more effective than treatment with surgery alone, particularly when the sarcoma cannot be removed with sufficient margins without compromising the function of the limb, which is the most common site for, or most common anatomic site for where soft tissue sarcomas arise, or other body part. This is because sarcomas, as Dr. Dimitri mentioned, tend to infiltrate into normal tissues adjacent to the tumor, and surgical attempts to remove all tumor cells might require more radical surgery or rarely even amputation for tumors of the arms or legs or removal of critical tissues in the abdomen or the head and neck region if the sarcoma is arising there. And these more radical surgical procedures might compromise limb function or result in a cosmetic or other functional deficit. It turns out that radiation is actually quite effective at eliminating microscopic tumor cells in such a way that it also, at those doses, provides a reasonably good sparing of the healthy normal tissue adjacent to the tumor. And when it's combined with a surgical procedure that removes all visible tumor, the radiation is really designed to just eradicate that microscopic residual disease. And this can be an effective strategy that can control the tumor in the overwhelming majority of patients, particularly in the extremities, where we often think of that the local tumor control is going to be above 90%, and optimize the function of the limb. It turns out radiation can be given by several different techniques, which depend on the location and size of the tumor, and it can be given, as Dr. Wayne mentioned, either before or after surgery. In some cases, the radiation is given after the tumor is surgically removed, and the kinds of treatments we're talking about usually, at least for external radiations, would involve starting the radiation treatments 4 to 6 weeks after surgery, and then the treatments themselves last for 5 to 6.5 weeks. Another option is to give about 5 weeks of radiation before the surgery, and then surgery follows 4 to 8 weeks later. And each approach, the preoperative radiation or the postoperative radiation, have relative benefits or risks. And for example, when radiation is given before surgery, the physicians can usually give a lower radiation dose and you can treat a smaller field. And in this way, the amount of tissue exposed to the radiation is usually smaller and the dose is lower. Giving the radiation treatment before surgery also tends to cause fewer late side effects or potential side effects after the radiation. Although some patients, again, as you give radiation before surgery, may have a delay in their surgical healing. Some side effects that you may have heard of related to radiation treatment can include what's called fibrosis, which is a condition where the tissues become firm and inflexible, or edema, swelling of the tissues, which can occur in some patients, particularly those who have large sarcomas in the groin region. Some ongoing clinical research studies, however, are looking at trying to reduce the side effects of treatment, and I'll mention some of those before this session is done. If the patient has surgery first, we wait until the surgical wounds heal before the radiation treatment starts, because the radiation can affect, as I mentioned earlier, the wound healing. The preference for giving radiation before surgery or after surgery will depend upon a variety of factors, so the patients will need to discuss the specifics and the rationale for the recommended treatment approach in each case with his or her medical team. And as I mentioned or alluded to, there are several ways the radiation can be done. The most common is what's called external beam radiation therapy, on which the radiation is delivered to the tumor by a machine, which is outside of the body. Another is called brachytherapy, which involves placing radiation sources inside tubes that are placed into the tumor bed at the time of the surgical removal of the tumor. About a week after surgery, these tubes are loaded with radiation sources for a period of about 5 days. In the past, patients had to be in the hospital for the delivery of the radiation treatment, but increasingly patients can now be brought a couple of times per day from their hospital room to the radiation department, or if they've been discharged for the hospital, from the hospital from home, and radiation sources can be painlessly inserted and removed by a special machine in the Department of Radiation Oncology. And this approach is more convenient for the patients and their families, and also gets rid of any visiting restrictions which were required in the past when the patients were treated in their hospital room with radiation sources that were left in place for the whole five-day period. Another option you may have heard of is called intraoperative radiation. In this procedure, the surgery is done in a suite, or a piece of equipment is brought into the room where, in fact, radiation can be delivered to the tumor bed at the time of the surgical procedure. And now this is used in particular for some intra-abdominal sarcomas. And it's important for patients to discuss these options with their medical team. In general, our goals of treatment, at least from the local perspective, are to attempt to remove as much of the cancer as possible while preserving as much of the organ function as possible. Occasionally, a sarcoma cannot be removed with either without amputating a limb or causing a major reduction in the function of the extremity. In such situations, radiation is sometimes used alone, either to shrink the tumor or help control the cancer while preserving limb function. And this may be an option, for example, for small sarcomas in the hand, for example. Lastly, for this relatively rare tumor, I think it's very important for patients, as Dr. Wayne had mentioned, to at least seek an opinion or preferably have treatment in a center which is experienced in sarcoma treatment. At this point, I want to move on to just discuss the how research contributes to treatment options, and in particular, how what we refer to as clinical trials offer potential improvements for both the patient and for our understanding of sarcomas. Progress in treatment of both of sarcomas and other cancers is critically dependent upon clinical trials. In the area of sarcomas in particular, what we refer to as randomized clinical trials, where patients were treated in one of two ways, were important in establishing that conservative surgery and radiation for sarcomas of the arms and legs was comparable in terms of overall survival to amputations. And as such, it answered a very important question as what the most appropriate kind of surgery is for patients with soft tissue sarcomas, as well as the role for radiation therapy. It also established that conservative surgery and radiation resulted in higher rates of tumor control than in some patients than surgery alone. As Dr. Dimitri had mentioned, ongoing clinical trials are now testing new drugs that target specific tumor growth pathways in sarcomas that I think are going to be very important in the future. From the radiation perspective, we recently completed a trial in the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group, a national cooperative clinical trials group that was specifically designed to apply improved imaging of the area being treated, as well as targeting a more carefully defined area around the tumor, thus treating a smaller area. And the results of this study are currently pending, but it has completed the accrual of all the patients who are planned to be entered onto the studies. And we are currently in the midst of designing subsequent studies, and this is done in conjunction with surgeons and medical oncologists, in essence, to try to improve our treatment and understanding of sarcomas. You can get information about clinical trials both from your physicians as well as from the National Cancer Institute website and the National Cooperative Cancer Clinical Trials Groups. I want to briefly, before I conclude, just make a couple of remarks about communicating with your healthcare team. This is extremely important. Many of the physicians will meet sarcoma patients in clinics that include multiple members of the team. It's important for the patients to know who the individual members are and what their role is. I think Dr. Dimitri touched upon this. The teams also involve physicians you may not necessarily see, such as the pathologists who may be in the background but are critical in working with us to decide exactly what kind of tumor you might have and how it's best treated. For patients, it may be important to ask for written materials to help you understand the treatments that are being proposed. It's often very helpful to have a family member or friend accompany you for particularly the initial appointments where discussions about treatment options or plans are being conducted. Different members of the team may be the primary point person for the whole team and for you at various stages of the treatment. During radiation, for example, the first contact person will often be the radiation oncologist. And it's important for you as well as you speak with the physicians to understand what they're saying. We often tend to use jargon that you may not understand, and it's very important to ask if we use any words that you don't understand. There are a wide array of resources available to patients, both in individual institutions as well as through various cancer resources such as Cancer Care and the NCI. So I think at this point I'll go ahead and turn it back to Carolyn. We'll open it up for questions.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Delaney, for just a very comprehensive and excellent presentation of lots of information. Just exquisite. Thank you. This has been an amazing. You have, all of you on the call now have seen this multidisciplinary team in action working together to give you information. And now we have time for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And I'm going to ask Carolina to bring all of our speakers on board for the Q&A. And if, Carolina, you would explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. And we'll try to take as many as possible.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may do so by pressing the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking on Ask a Question. And we have a question from Davey N. Please go ahead.
Hello, and I don't talk to you all, so my wife might have to talk a bit. I really appreciate you all being honest, but I had squamous cell carcinoma of the left anterior tongue 7 years ago. And I had half my tongue removed, the base, well, not the base, but half my lateral side removed 7 years ago at UC Southwest. And I had radiation and cisplatin chemotherapy after, and I've been cancer-free for 7 years.
And did you have a question?
Recently I had a mushroom growth pop up, and it was removed and sent for evaluation, has been found as a spindle cell sarcoma of the tongue, and I have had subsequent surgery of a centimeter to remove it. My margin was only 1 millimeter.
So, I'm just going to ask you what your question is, please.
My question, are there any other alternatives, chemotherapy-wise or radiation-wise, besides just keeping cutting on the tongue?
Right. Well, I think you have, first of all, brought up many important questions. This is George Dimitri. First and foremost, certainly radiation in the past is one of the things that we do see occasionally associated with sarcomas later on. We see this increasingly in women who have radiation for breast cancer, where they're cured of the breast cancer. But a small number of women, unfortunately, can then develop a radiation-associated sarcoma later on. Now, we cannot, none of us can give any individual specific advice to anyone, and I would say this is a great example of where having a team evaluate you and just see, is there anything else that need be done? Because the details matter in medicine. It matters a lot about where the surgery was done most recently, what the rest of the staging studies are, CAT scans and things like that. So I think none of us would be very willing or would be wise to give you any more specific advice than it's a good reason to see a group that has some experience in sarcomas. In general, for radiation-associated sarcomas, and Tom, maybe you can comment on this, in general, we tend to watch those patients more than give extra radiation. But I just wonder if Dr. Delaney has anything else to say. And then last thing, from a drug standpoint, if somebody does not have any disease, I am usually averse to giving drugs which always have some side effects, and we don't know whether any drugs in this situation would have a benefit.
Thank you, George. Fortunately, these kinds of radiation-associated second tumors, radiation-associated sarcomas, are, as George mentioned, relatively rare. The National Cancer Institute released recent information estimating that in 1,000 patients who had survived 15 years after treatment of their cancer with radiation, about 5 of them, if cured, would develop a second tumor related to the prior radiation. So it's about 0.5% at 15 years. But they can be challenging to manage because it's certainly more difficult to try to give additional radiation to this area. So there's, in fact, a very important emphasis on surgical management of these patients, often trying to remove the tumor, sometimes bringing in healthy tissue that hasn't previously been radiated, using plastic surgical techniques and flaps to do so, and reserving radiation only for situations where you can't get an adequate margin, or sometimes they'll use techniques where at the time of the removal of the tumor you can place some radiation sources in and around the area. That being said, when we do have to re-irradiate the patients, we can use brachytherapy, as I mentioned. There's a technology called intensity-modulated radiation therapy where you can focus the radiation on the area being treated, and there's another technology called protons, which deliver less dose to the surrounding normal tissue, which are important for management of these kinds of problems, which can at times be a challenge because some of the tools we would commonly use, such as radiation in the head and neck region, it's difficult to go back and re-irradiate the head and neck area without a higher risk of injury to the normal tissues in that area.
And I want to also recommend that you certainly take all this information back to your treating healthcare team. And I want to thank you for that excellent question, a very complex question, and that you certainly have engaged all of our speakers in terms of trying to help to get an answer, but the specifics you want to go back to your treating healthcare team, that's very important. We have another question now from one of our online participants, and the question is, for a sarcoma in the upper arm extremity, is the area for checking still the lungs for possible spreading based on current medical knowledge, or are there other areas of future concern? Dr. Dimitri, would you like to start with that?
Yeah, well, there's never really been a study that says we should do one type of X-ray for surveillance to make sure that other sites of disease don't crop up. For most sarcomas, the lungs are certainly the highest risk area in the body to have this show up. I would say 85, depending on the type of sarcoma. Remember, just because a sarcoma starts in the arm, there are many kinds of sarcomas that could start in the arm. But I would say, 80% of the risk of it coming back would be in the lung. That leaves 20% of risk somewhere else, usually I would say somewhere in the liver. So usually many of the chest CT scans will also include the liver on many of the images. So we typically do some imaging of the chest, and we'll think about how to watch out for the liver or some other part of the body, be it physical examination, lab testing, or CAT scan surveillance. But we don't really base this on data. And Jeff, I don't know what you do in your practice. We have guidelines for this, but
I think you try to have to make a rational strategy that also minimizes the deleterious effects of additional radiation, which we all are becoming more aware of. And so I think based on the size, the grade, and the location of the primary tumor, we try to make a rational a strategy for follow-up, both in the primary site and in what we think is the most common metastatic site. And again, I think for most upper extremity lesions, that still would be the lungs in my mind. And so that would be, we wouldn't routinely get CT scans of the of the abdomen and pelvis in a patient like that, unless it was one of these unusual myxoid liposarcomas, which we know can sometimes have metachronous disease in the abdomen, or disease that comes sometime after the primary is discovered within the abdomen. And then maybe once a year we'll scan the abdomen. But I think primarily for the extremities, the lung is still the most common site of metastasis.
Excellent. We actually have another question from one of our online participants, and that is, can you please list a few of the sarcoma specialized centers?
Of course, the ones we come from. I mean, that's really the problem, is that we don't want to appear self-serving here. And I think the Sarcoma Alliance has a list of this, and I think it's a reasonable thing to ask your doctors. you know, where would you suggest? Where have you sent patients with this disease? I mean, there's a lot of places. The National Comprehensive Cancer Centers, there are 65 of them in the country, one at least in every state, except Alaska. So I think those are reasonably good places. Now, not every comprehensive cancer center has a big sarcoma team, but most of the time they have something. But the big three, the biggest three by volume, certainly are going to be Dana-Farber Harvard, Memorial Sloan Kettering, and the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Those are the big three. And then there are many other places. And Jeff, I don't want to, since you're from the none of the big three, how would you phrase it?
Yeah, I think the NCCN centers are a great place to start. For the reason that, there should be a member from most of institutions on each of the panels and hopefully on the sarcoma panel. And so hopefully there is a resource that, if not a large sarcoma team, that there is a resource for finding an appropriate referral to a larger sarcoma team if that's what is necessary. So I think the NCCN website is a great place to start. First of all, to take a look at the guidelines and see are your physicians kind of treating you within what might be considered to be the current guidelines, and to potentially find a source of referral. As George mentions, we've geographically managed to expand and spread out and are now cover a fair amount of the at least the continental United States. These are good questions to ask your physician when you start to explore treatment options for sarcoma. Do you have a sarcoma team? Do you have a monthly sarcoma meeting or tumor board where these cases are discussed in a multidisciplinary setting? Have my pathology slides been reviewed by a pathologist who has expertise in sarcoma pathology, or have they been sent out to another center for review if that's not possible? Those are the things that you want to ask. And again, I think there's also other sarcoma patient advocacy websites that provide lists of centers of expertise.
In your materials, you have information about certainly the National Cancer Institute information, as well as a number of the sarcoma organizations as well as resources. So thank you. Our next question, Carolina?
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Marilyn B. Please go ahead.
Okay. It sounds like the doctors at the various sarcoma centers are sharing information about the latest treatment protocols, which is great. Are you aware of any specific clinical trials for treatment of leiomyosarcoma in the abdominal cavity in cases where it has recurred?
Excellent question. Thank you, Dr. Dimitri.
If I can take that, there are actually lots of clinical trials for leiomyosarcoma. And the first thing to emphasize is that leiomyosarcoma of the abdomen, diagnosis is absolutely critical because some of those leiomyosarcomas may actually be this other sarcoma of the abdomen called gastrointestinal stromal tumor. It doesn't happen much anymore. The pathologists are generally attuned to this at most hospitals in the country. But once in a while, we still see somebody who gets called a leiomyosarcoma, but it's truly a GIST, gastrointestinal stromal tumor, GIST. That makes a huge difference because instead of being treated with chemotherapy, that is absolutely treated with targeted therapies with drugs called things like Gleevec or Sutent. Those are the commercial trade names with generic names like imatinib or sunitinib. So I think number one, always question the diagnosis. Upon referral to any good sarcoma center, most of us re-review the pathology just to be sure the diagnosis is as billed. And then separately, there are lots of good clinical trials for leiomyosarcoma. It matters if the patient has ever had chemotherapy before or not. So let's start with that. For patients who have never had chemotherapy, sometimes the first trial is an important thing to discuss with the doctor as well. There are many trials where if you've ever had chemotherapy, you are no longer eligible. It has to be people who have never had chemotherapy. So that's one place to make a decision and to know you have the right menu of options in front of you. If somebody's already had chemotherapy and it either stopped working or it never worked or it was given a long time ago and now the disease is waking up again, there are many national studies right now specifically focused on leiomyosarcoma. It's a very interesting time. There are big comparative studies where half the patients will get one drug, a standard drug, half the patients will get a new drug. The two studies are ongoing right now in that very situation, one testing a standard drug called dacarbazine, which is also known as DTIC, a good old-fashioned standby drug from the 1960s, and the experimental drug in one study is a marine-derived drug, comes from a sea squirt, called ET743, or trabectedin. It's approved in Europe under the trade name of Yondelis. That's one trial. And another trial takes the same standard drug, that dacarbazine or DTIC, and the experimental drug is another marine-derived drug called Halaven or Eribulin, which is FDA-approved only for the treatment of breast cancer in the United States. It's nice to see two big companies actually doing large-scale studies in sarcoma patients, and the only sarcoma patients eligible for those two trials are people with leiomyosarcoma or a fat sarcoma called liposarcoma. So there are trials, and at Dana-Farber we have at least five other studies, and there are many other studies at other places for patients with leiomyosarcomas.
So this is an excellent answer to this question, very promising studies out there, so this is really important for everyone to understand the importance of just accessing this information, and that's why we do these programs. So I thank you for that excellent question. We have another question from one of our online participants. For a patient with a high-grade mixed fibrosarcoma removed and treated with radiation, why is there no sentinel node testing for an upper extremity area? Dr. Delaney, would you address that?
Or I can grab that one if you want.
Yes.
Hi, it's Dr. Wayne. The sarcomas are different than other tumors in that they primarily spread by the bloodstream, or what we call a hematogenous metastasis. That's why the lungs are primarily the most common site of metastasis, at least from the extremity lesions, especially upper extremity lesions. Now, interestingly, unlike breast cancer, lung cancer, melanoma, some of the other more common cancers that we think of, colon cancer, these sarcomas tend not to spread via the lymphatic system, and thus metastasis to lymph nodes, while not unheard of, certainly are quite rare. And so, as opposed to breast cancer or melanoma, where the spread to lymphatics or lymph nodes is usually the first sign of regional metastasis, in sarcoma, spread to the lymph nodes is very rare. And so sentinel node biopsy is not typically undertaken. In other words, sentinel node biopsy, for those of you not familiar with that, is testing of the first lymph node or sentinel node that drains a particular area, you know, most often the skin or breast tissue, and then is tested in a very comprehensive way. Sentinel node biopsy is not typically undertaken in sarcoma because lymph node metastasis are quite rare. And so the exceptions to this might be angiosarcomas, lymphangiosarcomas, epithelioid sarcomas, clear cell sarcomas, and embryonal rhabdomyosarcomas, where lymph node metastasis has been reported with more frequency. And in those cases, if you have a surgeon who has expertise in that technique, it can be discussed as a potential adjunct to the resection of the primary lesion. But in general, extensive lymph node dissections for sarcoma would not be undertaken. So, for instance, if you have a GI stromal tumor of the stomach, which is a rare sarcoma of the stomach, you would not resect that with all the perigastric lymph nodes like you might if the patient had a gastric cancer or a traditional stomach cancer, where lymph node metastasis, again, is quite common and where resecting those lymph nodes is an important goal of therapy. But again, in sarcoma, lymph node metastasis, I think just to talk in general, lymph node metastasis is quite rare, and thus extensive lymph node dissections in general and sentinel node biopsies in particular are not typically undertaken.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, Carolina.
Thank you. We have a question from the line of Cynthia W. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Cynthia, and I'm from Texas, and I appreciate you speakers so much. My husband has angiosarcoma, and it's in the mastoid area, and he's been working with this for the last 3 years. And my question is would brachytherapy be an option in that area?
Thank you.
Hi, it's Dr. Delaney. I can comment on that.
Yes.
Brachytherapy can be difficult to deliver in bone. It has been done occasionally, but we usually tend to use more external beam techniques for this. You didn't mention whether this area has previously had radiation. That's important to clarify in terms of thinking about the treatment techniques.
Okay, thank you. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, really exceptional. And also, I just all of you can see this magnificent team of physicians, and all of you want to replicate this with your own treating team as well. I want to thank our speakers. I want to thank all of you who both asked questions on the phone or actually online. Thank you very much. Excellent questions, which enhanced our call. And all of you who've been listening. I want to acknowledge that this is a one-hour conference call and remind you that there are many services that you can access when this call concludes, which will be in a few minutes. So I want to remind you of what those services are, because we don't want anyone to leave the call feeling like, oh, I have another question, or I didn't get my question answered, or I have some other concerns that I might have. So I want to review with you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. They're quite varied. Cancer Care has a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services for you, from practical and financial assistance to counseling, someone to talk to both on the telephone or online. We offer support groups both on the telephone and online, and we also have workshops like this and various publications and fact sheets. As I mentioned earlier, you will be getting a booklet shortly, actually on sarcoma, that's been printed and off the press that you'll be get to as another helpful asset for you in coping with sarcoma. So we are available to help you. We are also entering a time of year, a holiday time of year, when all of you may have many other concerns as well, and I want you to know that you're not alone in coping with soft tissue sarcoma, with your cancer. We want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we are truly here to help you. We are simply a phone call away, 1-800-813-HOPE. And for our international participants or those who prefer to visit us online, go to www.cancercare.org. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect. Have a wonderful day.